contrive to see the distance between his neighbors and himself. But when it came to his own obligations to his neighbor, he was the good neighbor. He saw himself as the neighbor. He did not see his neighbors when they acted towards him, because there he could stand alone. But when it came to his actions, he acted out the part of the neighbor. He was always the neighbor in his relations with others. So it's a very interesting dialectic, and a very tricky one, because it's very often easier to see only one side of the dialectic and to forget the other, and to forget the very intimate relationship that there can exist between the two of them. Now, I would like to explore this a little further and show its applications within the framework of Greek philosophy and the influence that this point of view had on Christianity as it became a missionary religion. Oh, with some of the early Christians consciously being Hellenists, particularly Paul. Paul was a Hellenist, a Hellenistic Jew, but a Hellenist. There were lots of Jews who were not Hellenists. On the contrary, they fought against Hellenism. But Paul was a self-conscious Hellenistic Jew. And before him, Stephen, one of the seven deacons of the original church, to whom the apostles in Jerusalem delegated some authority. Six of the seven were Jews. One wasn't. Stephen was the leader among them. Stephen was a Hellenist, a Hellenistic Jew. And it made all the difference in the world, literally for the world, that these men were the kinds of men that they were, because it was through certain Hellenistic conceptions that Hellenism, that Christianity was able to project itself as a world religion. Well, I'm going to let you make your buses or flights at this point, because the point I want to develop will take more than the 10 or 15 minutes we have left. So have a happy Easter. At the end of the hour on Wednesday, in our discussion of Stoic philosophy, we were trying to explain, following our discussion of the internalization process which the Stoics had developed as the heart of their philosophy, that they reached the conclusion which Sophocles had projected in Oedipus the King, that there is a fundamental difference between suffering and punishment, and that no moral judgment can be attached to suffering as there can be to punishment. Now this much we had discussed. Now let me add a word or two, which I want to do with respect to the second point, the one relating to suffering. I want to explain very briefly that point follows naturally from the first point. That is to say that once a position is taken that the real man is the internal man, then it follows that the real man must be indifferent to everything that is external to him. He must be really indifferent to wealth if it comes to him, or poverty if that comes to him, to power when that comes to him, as for example, Marcus Aurelius, as the emperor, he had plenty of power, he had lots of property. So those are obvious externals. But then he applied it further. His body too is external to him. He is not, as in the Old Testament conception, in the Hebraic conception, a unity, a whole of body and soul. But now, by this time, it is possible to differentiate the inner from the outer man, the soul from the body. And he conceived of himself as identified with his soul, and therefore he must be indifferent to his body. His body can enjoy pleasure, his body can suffer pain, but they are like wealth or poverty. They are like power or powerlessness. And so it must follow from that kind of an analysis, which involves a kind of appealing process. You take off layers as they accumulate upon one and identify them all as foreign, as alien, as external, as separable from the real self. They come and they go. Pain comes and it goes, but you remain. Wealth comes and goes, but you remain. Reputation, whatever it may be. Beauty and disfigurement, they come and they go. But what remains is the man that can pass moral judgment, the inner man. And the inner man, as he acts out his moral judgment, his reason. His reason here identified with the moral judgment. This is the true man, and that no one can deprive me of. No one can reach that. I might be coerced in my body, I might be hurt in all kinds of ways, a good deal like Job. The essence of the position is not in any essential way different from the experience related by Job, and ultimately the resolution of that problem, and then of Oedipus too. Now you have it on a level of abstraction, which we didn't have before. Before we had a dramatization, an action. Job acted. Oedipus acted and was acted upon. Words were uttered, but they were part of the action. The words of Job are part of an action. The words of Oedipus are part of an action. They come out of a living experience. But when we come to the Stoics, we have a philosophy. We have a conceptualization. And by this time, with the influence of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and the other Greek philosophers, man had learned to conceptualize. Before that, it either wasn't possible or it was too difficult. It wasn't congenial. But in Marcus Aurelius, you have a conceptualization. And you have statements. And they are reflective upon life in a broad, general way. And what you have left then is the identification of man with his moral will. And over that, he is the master. No one, and even God himself, can compel his moral judgment. There he is free. There are some very beautiful passages in the Meditations. Your evil does not consist in another's governing principle, nor indeed in any change or alteration of your environment, as you can't blame society You can't blame the city. You can't blame your civilization, your culture. Over these you have no control, very limited control, if any. So your evil doesn't consist in the governing principle that operates in other men, what they do to me, or in any change of the environment. Where then? Where the part of you which judges about evil is. As knowledge is virtue. If your knowledge is corrupt, this goes back to a Socratic judgment, and ultimately you could trace this kind of an attitude back also to the Bible. If you know what is commanded of you, it's the knowledge, then you can act in accordance with the commandment, in accordance with virtue. If you don't know, then of course you're nothing but an animal. You're nothing but a creature. You're acted upon, but you're not an actor. Even when you act, you are acting only as a reaction. Your action is only a reaction. But it's not really yourself involving, as we would say today, existentially, as it were, putting yourself into the act. So where then? Where the part of you which judges about evil is, let it not frame the judgment, and all is well. Even if what is nearest to it, your body, is cut, cauterized, suppurates, mortifies, still let the part which judges about these things be at rest. As if you are, say, Job on the rack, you suffer all the pains that one could possibly conceive of, but your judgment must be at rest. Your judgment your mind must pass the right moral judgment on what is happening. That is, let it decide that nothing is good or evil which can happen indifferently to the evil man and to the good. Where I am suffering, an evil man could suffer, a good man could suffer. It therefore ought to be a matter of total indifference from the point of view of moral judgment. It has nothing to do with the moral order of myself or of the world, of the universe. Another passage. Can what has befallen you prevent your being just, high-minded, temperate, prudent, free from rash judgments, trustful, self-reverent, says self-respecting, having a sense of self-dignity, free, and whatever else by its presence with him enables a man's nature to secure what is really his. Finally, in every event which leads you to sorrow, remember to use this principle, that this is not a misfortune, but that to bear it like a brave man is good fortune. Because what happens to a man is neither good nor bad, but the way he reacts to what happens, that's where the man is. And that's where the judgment must be. Now, I dare say this marks a great bit of progress in the development and the refinement of the moral sense and of the religious sensibility of man. Now, let me move on from there to another aspect which is tremendously important. The internalization process that we've been talking about, obviously, when you stop and think of it, has its dangers. You can push it to the point where a man can be completely isolated internally, and he can externalize that isolation. Or people have done that. They have carried their asceticism to an extreme degree, remove themselves, run away from life, from the world, found some remote hiding place physically, as reflective of their internal alienation. Like the people, the Essenes, for example, at Qumran, who gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls, living on the Dead Sea in caves. They ran away from society, from civilization. Some suspect, even from their wives, perhaps, and their children, though there were different kinds of communities, communes. This was one of the early ancient communes. The monastic system has in it, in Christianity, some aspects, and in other religions as well, in Hinduism, in Buddhism. The guru, the man who removes himself, some of them, not all, from his fellows, from society. No obligations, he owes nothing to anybody, nobody owes him anything, and his wants are very, very meager. He has no expectations. Life can be reduced to that level. The Stoics were aware of this, and some Stoics pushed the process that we've been discussing to that extreme. The invitation to do that is obvious, and sometimes the temptation, considering the kind of a society in which one lives and the kind of person one is, may be great. But the leading Stoic philosophers, including Marcus Aurelius, didn't do that. They drew the line, and it's a very interesting, delicate point that requires some consideration. Let me read to you a number of passages by way of an introduction to what Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus and others try to do. This is their view. This is from Book 2, the first passage in Book 2 of the Meditations. It's a lovely passage, a very interesting one in any case. Say to yourself early in the morning, I shall meet today inquisitive, ungrateful, violent, treacherous, envious, uncharitable men. All these things have come upon them through ignorance of real good and evil. But I, because I have seen that the nature of good is the right and of the evil the wrong, and that the nature of the man himself who does wrong is like my own nature, not of the same blood and seed, but partaking with me in mind, that is in a portion of divinity, I can neither be harmed by any of them, for no man will involve me in wrongdoing, nor can I be angry with my kinsman, nor can I hate him, for we have come into the world to work together, like feet, like hands, like eyelids, like the rows of upper and lower teeth. To work against one another, therefore, is to oppose nature. And to be vexed with another or to turn away from him is to tend to antagonism. This is very much like a passage that I read to you. I forget whether it was from, I think it was from Corinthians by St. Paul. The organic view of man. We have come into the world to work together like feet, like hands, like eyelids, like the rows of upper and lower teeth. Man is not separable from other men. Man, by his very nature, is part of an organism. And if you remove a man from the rest of the organism, that's from society, it's like removing a tooth from the mouth. It's no longer a tooth. It doesn't function as a tooth or a finger that is cut off. It's no longer a finger. It was a finger. It was a tooth. But removed from the body, it's something else. It's just matter. And this is the nature of man. Another passage. In each case, we must say, this has come from God, this by the actual coordination of events, the complicated web and similar coincidence or chance. This has come from my fellow man, my kinsman, my comrade. Yet one who does not know what is natural for himself. But I do know. Wherefore I use him kindly and justly according to the natural law of fellowship. As he may not know that he is a fellow man. So he behaves like a wolf, like a bear, like a tiger to me. But I know that I am a fellow man. So I must act towards him as befits a fellow man. I must act kindly in accordance with the demands of justice, justly, according to the natural law of fellowship. There are many, many such passages about this. Here's a very famous one and a very telling one. Now, the advantage of each man is what is proper to his own constitution and nature. And my nature is reasonable and social. As Marcus Aurelius, my city and my fatherland is Rome. As a man, the universe. All then that benefits these cities is alone my good. As the universe is a city, Rome is a city. As Marcus Aurelius, my city and my fatherland is Rome. But as a man, my city is the universe. All then that befits these cities is alone my good. He's not one who will put himself in a cave at Qumran or any place else. He's a citizen of Rome and a citizen of the world by nature. That is his nature. That is the nature of man. He knows his nature. Other people don't. They behave different. May behave differently. But he knows. So he must behave in accordance with the demands of nature. Well, one more passage on this. Calm in respect of what comes to pass from a cause outside you. As whatever comes to pass from the outside, external, face it with calmness. Justice in acts done in accord with a cause from yourself. What may happen to me may come from injustice. I must face it calmly. But in acts done in accordance with a cause from myself, justice. That is to say, impulse and act terminating simply in neighborly conduct, because for you this is according to nature. As I am a neighbor. I must act as a neighbor. I cannot act except as a neighbor. My inner self is the inner self of a neighbor. It's not the inner self of one who was not a fellow man. So you see where there is built into the concept of alienation, of internalization, a guard against carrying that notion to an extreme. The kind of self that seeks alienation must be a self which is that of a fellow man. Now, being a fellow man, being a neighbor, Marcus Aurelius recognized all of the time that he had his civic and his social duties. And those duties oblige him always to act justly towards other men. At the same time, the dialectic here is very subtle and very difficult to express. At the very same time, he is an isolated self, independent of all men and all external circumstances. As it's not a logic of either or. Either you're the internal self or you are the social external self. You are both at one and the same time. As a person acted upon, you must react as if you are an isolated self. At that point, you internalize. Because whatever other men may do to me, they can do only to what is external to me. They may never, never breach the inner wall of the citadel. There I am completely protected. But when it comes to my acting, then I must act as a fellow man. I must act as a neighbor. I must act as one who has constantly to exercise his moral judgment and his moral will. Now, it is this same distinction, of course, that was made in another context and not explicated to the same degree by Socrates. It is implicit more than explicit in Socrates. You can evolve it, of course, from the position he took when he was on trial. In his apology, he took the position, and later on in the Crito in prison, "The Athenians have acted unjustly towards me," he said. "They have handed down a verdict which is certainly an outrage of justice. But that is their guilt, not mine. It's their responsibility. And what they do does not touch my soul. It doesn't taint my soul. I have none of that guilt that they have. What they do to me, something awful that they are about to do to me. But that's their doing and not mine. Now, I am willing to suffer the injustice, but you cannot force me to commit an injustice. Nothing in the world. I would rather die, and I'm about to die, rather than to commit what my soul would consider an unjust act. There I am free. I am a free man. I am not free when it comes to drinking the cup of hemlock, which will be forced upon me. But I am free to act in such a way that I must accept the cup of hemlock, because that's the price I am compelled to pay for exercising my free moral judgment, which dictates to me that I must not commit an injustice to my soul, and I won't. As the injustice to his soul is twofold there. First, he will always act as Socrates must act, and that is to prove that he's trying to know himself, that he's living for his soul by engaging in the Socratic dialogue constantly. The Athenians don't want him to do that. He can't live without it, because that's the way his own soul will discover the truth. And if he can't have the truth, life isn't worth living. But also, he will not run away. He was offered the opportunity to escape from prison. That would be an injustice to his city, to Athens. He would be violating the law. Violating the law for his own convenience, that he would never do. It's not unconscionable for him to stay in prison. It's unconscionable for the Athenians to keep him there. But that's their guilt and not his. So you see, in that incident you have, and in the few remarks made by Socrates, you've got the beginnings, and I think historically that's probably the case, the beginnings of the Stoic philosophy. And Zeno, when he came to Athens, was more of a disciple of Socrates than he was of any other philosopher.